This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, so do you like literally cringe when someone uses a word or phrase improperly? Our guest makes the case for the good in bad English. Now, a recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that health insurance providers are rejecting claims at a higher rate in recent years than they used to. Patients can appeal those denials, but many don't know how or even that they can, or they don't have the time and energy to work through what can be a complicated, drawn-out process. Under the Affordable Care Act, the Department of Health and Human Services is supposed to provide government oversight for health insurance denials. But health coverage experts say the system hasn't gotten as much attention as it should. As a result, many patients have been left with expensive medical bills for health care that they thought would be covered by their insurance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has that happened to you? Have you or a loved one dealt with a health insurance claim being denied? You can share your story. What kind of explanation were you given? Did you try to appeal that decision? Was that successful? What questions do you have about how this system has changed over time? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Rosenthal is a senior contributing editor for KFF Health News and previously practiced medicine in New York. She's the author of the book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She wrote a recent opinion column for the Washington Post called Denials of Health Insurance Claims Are Rising and Getting Weirder. Elizabeth, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you talk, first of all, about this apparent increase in the number of rejected health insurance claims? How big is the scope of this?
Well, the problem is we really don't know because the Affordable Care Act tasked the government to track denials, and they really haven't done so. They've only done so in a small subset of plans. And in that small subset, these are just the plans that reported that are covered by the Obamacare marketplace. We see an average of 17% denials, but some plans denied 49%, and one plan in 2020 denied 80% of claims. So that's quite alarming. I mean, when I was practicing, the denials practice was in place in the 90s, but it was really used to deny or to vet really, really expensive treatments, like where doctors and hospitals doing stuff just to make money, right? Rather than for the patient good instead of for the patient good. Now it's trickled down to like everything and anything. And, as I said before, the government was supposed to track this because the big fear when the Affordable Care Act was passed, I don't know if we remember this, but before the ACA, it was legal for insurers to deny people insurance with pre-existing conditions. That was called cherry picking, and that was kind of to assure they had the most optimal income. And the worry was, well, if you can't cherry pick your patients who you're going to cover, maybe you'll just deny a lot more care. That's another way to make money. So for that very reason, the authors of the Affordable Care Act said, you need to track these denials. There has to be oversight. And that just hasn't been done. So here we are, you know, with this familiar experience of getting what you think is routine care and bingo, not covered.
Now, I picture this process as like, okay, the claim goes to the insurer and a person sits down and carefully reviews the claim and looks and compares it to the standards and, you know, goes through this process. As you write, there might be an algorithm. A human might look at this thing for 1.2 seconds, if I read this right. Could you talk about what has changed in this process?
If that, I mean, a lot of it, you know, in the 90s, when this was rare, the concept was a qualified healthcare provider would look at a claim to see if that kind of treatment was really warranted in a patient's care, particularly for very expensive things. It was rare, and it was meted out very carefully. Now, what's happened, of course, since the 90s is there's automation, right? So there's automated claims denial. Like you said, often we see that at some insurers, the ProPublica investigation found that claims were being processed like at 1.2 seconds, right? Which means that the process, if there's a human processor, they're not looking at the chart, right? A computer is just looking for, are there certain words in the claim that justify this medicine or this procedure? And even worse, I think the thing that disturbs me the most is now often claims are denied, not because it's not the right treatment for the patient, but because your insurer may not have a contract with that particular drug manufacturer, device manufacturer. So what we see now, and we've all had this experience, is you go to the pharmacy counter for something you've been taking for years, right? An asthma inhaler, a medicine for type 2 diabetes, and you're suddenly told, no, your plan isn't covering that. That's not because it's not good for you. It's because your plan has changed contracts with the drug manufacturer and they want to change you to something different. It may be something different that's in theory equally as good. It may be a generic equivalent, but or it may be just a different generic. But like if you've spent the last couple of years doing well on a certain kind of insulin or with a certain kind of asthma inhaler, you really don't want to switch, right? It's not good medicine.
One more point you wrote about before we go to our callers is often the explanations given to patients are more or less, when doctors look at them, gibberish. They don't make a lot of human sense. What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of boilerplate language in all the denials. I mean, my favorite quote in the story was Deirdre O'Reilly, who's a physician at the University of Vermont. Her son, who had an anaphylactic reaction, went to an emergency room. His life was saved. He was given life-saving treatment with epinephrine and steroids. And the claim was denied. And she was like, whoa, wait a second. That's not right. And she said the denials were almost impossible to appeal because she said it was just gobbledygook. It's, you know, sometimes it's not medically necessary. Sometimes it doesn't meet the right condition. Sometimes it's pages and pages of just kind of boilerplate paragraphs. And it doesn't give you enough information to even say, wait, even if you're a physician, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense.
Talking to Elizabeth Rosenthal with KFF Health News about a piece she wrote in the Washington Post about an increase, at least to the extent we can tell from the data out there, in the number of rejections by health insurance providers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your experiences. Lisa is with us now in Madison. Lisa, what did you want to tell us about?
Hi. So recently we received letters, my daughter and I, for services we had, and we were informed by the hospital and clinic that they were appealing a claim that we didn't even know hadn't been denied. So I'm wondering if hospitals and clinics are hiring people because if somebody can't pay it, then it goes to bankruptcy and they're recouping less money.
Interesting. Elizabeth, is this something just hitting the patients themselves or, as Lisa says, hospitals and clinics too?
Well, hospitals and clinics, too, and they will frequently, if you're lucky, instead of just saying we're going to bill you, they will appeal, do at least a first pass try at appealing the denial. And maybe the insurer has said not medically necessary, and the hospital or clinic has looked at the chart and said, oh, we're going to give a little more information about the case in an appeal that's specific to the case to justify it. Because you're right, they would way prefer to get the full payment from the insurer than, or at least in most cases, hopefully to go after the patient or to recoup it in collections where they get pennies on the dollar. But so, you know, one strategy is to ask your provider's help in an appeal because, you know, mere mortals look at these denials and like go, well, why? What? I don't understand. My doctor told me this was necessary. Why isn't it being paid for?
Thanks a lot for that call, Lisa. Let's talk about that appeal process and the review process. If I go get healthcare, I think it's going to be covered. I get that notice it's not covered. What can I as a patient do?
Well, you can appeal, obviously, and just try. I mean, the problem is this takes so much time and energy, and not everyone has it, right? I will tell you, a friend of mine whose husband had a hip injury, clearly needs to get an MRI. Their insurer, it was scheduled for Friday. The insurer denied it. These are healthcare people. They appealed the claim. But, you know, claims appeals, they can take weeks, right? And people are suffering in the meantime. So, you know, yes, you can appeal. Probably better to ask your provider's help in appealing if you don't understand why it was rejected, because sometimes it's just the healthcare provider didn't provide enough information. But sometimes the causes are mysterious. And the thing that's really disturbing, the most disturbing thing to me in that KFF survey is that only 1 in 500 people appealed their claims. I mean, that's shocking. So I think the hope from the insurers, frankly, is that a lot of people just go away. Or maybe, you know, if they tell you at the pharmacy counter, oh, your insurer isn't covering this. If it's a small dollar amount, fine. You'll put out the $20 or the $40. But, you know, sometimes the bills are in the tens or hundreds of thousands, and that's not really an option.
We're talking to KFF Health News Senior Contributing Editor Elizabeth Rosenthal about a rise in health insurance claims being denied and a lack of oversight in the process. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about health insurance claims and rejections? Do you work in a healthcare-related field? Do you have experience dealing with insurance providers? Are there changes you'd like to see in the system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Elizabeth Rosenthal, Senior Contributing Editor of KFF Health News. She's with us today to discuss why health insurance companies appear to be denying more claims and what we can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Diane joins us now in Iron County. Diane, hi.
Hi. I went for my annual physical in February, and I had the same test done as the year before. And I had asked them to make sure everything was covered because I have been denied things. And comes out that I ended up getting a bill for more than half of the blood tests because they said they were no longer covering them. And I didn't need the test in the first place. I've always, whatever scored, had good results on all of these things anyhow. And then they told me that next year I have to ask what they're going to do before I get there. And I'm like, how do I know what to ask?
Diane, thanks for sharing that. So the expectation, it sounds like, from the insurance company is that Diane keep up with their changes in coverage, pre-screen what she's going to be screened for. A lot on the patient there, Elizabeth.
Yeah, it's so unfair to patients that every year, because it changes year to year, sometimes month to month. And how is a mere mortal supposed to know? And who has the time to do that? You know, under the ACA, an annual physical is supposed to be covered. Well, what does that include? That depends a bit on your insurer. And they change, like it's a moving target. And it's just so unfair to patients to expect them to ask. And it's really unfair to the providers as well to have to check, oh, this year, can I order magnesium? Or this year, can I order an iron test? It's a whole frustrating system where that wastes everyone's time. And this is what gets to me most. You know, the patients waste their time. They spend money they shouldn't have to spend. The doctor's offices have to hire people to argue these bills with the insurers. The insurers hire people to argue back. And all that money and all that time should just be going to our health. And it's not. It's just a national tragedy to me that this happens.
Well,
and I'm sorry to the caller.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that experience with us. Sorry that happened. John is with us now in Lake Halley. John, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I had an experience a few years ago where I had a knee surgery. While I was unconscious, they brought in a secondary surgeon to help with the surgery, but the second surgeon wasn't covered under my insurance. So when I appealed, they just said, well, you still got to pay for it.
John, John, wow. Okay. So Elizabeth, yeah, literally the patient is unconscious, obviously can't help with the decision of whether to get this second surgeon in on the operation. Is that something that's common where, I guess, extra help in a procedure is rejected?
I will say it's a kind of scammy kind of thing I've heard of before. Now, the good thing, but it won't help the caller, is that kind of thing is supposed to be illegal now under the No Surprises Act, because that is when you go to an in-network facility, you've chosen an in-network surgeon, and they call in someone that's out of your network. That's a surprise out-of-network bill. In theory, that is illegal now. Once again, the problem is to recoup your money or not have to pay that bill. It takes a lot of time and effort to argue it often. So, I say the patient is always left holding the bag, and that's just so wrong. I don't know what the outcome was, but, it's like holding patients hostage.
John, thanks for the call. Barbara is with us now in Madison. Barbara, hello.
Hello.
Hi, yeah. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a retired nurse and nurse anesthetist. I have had to contact insurance companies over the years for my patients because they were denied things that were necessary. But a few years ago, my sister's daughter-in-law had a baby. She's a very tiny little girl, and she had a very big baby, and she had a huge abdominal hernia.
And what? Oh, go ahead, Barbara.
The insurance company immediately said, that's cosmetic, we reject it. So they talked to me, and her father-in-law happens to be an attorney, which probably helped. But we recommended she get another opinion from a surgeon saying that this is necessary and that she should take pictures of this because it was unbelievable. She looked like she was still 9 months pregnant. And that she document how it impacted her quality of life. She couldn't pick up her baby. She couldn't carry clothes to the laundry. And they finally came around and paid, but I think the people who review these don't have medical knowledge.
Interesting, Barbara. Thanks for the call. And Elizabeth, not everybody has a sister-in-law who's a nurse and a father who's an attorney to advocate for them.
Yeah, and that's kind of the dream team you need to fight these effectively often, unfortunately. And I think, you're seeing here just the kind of persistence it takes. And when the caller talks about people not being qualified, well, the first pass may well be a machine. The second pass may well be, if you're lucky, someone with a bit of medical training looking for certain keywords that would justify payment. Then if you appeal again, you may get a physician, a generalist. But if, my neurologist has had to ask for a peer-to-peer with a neurologist. So you work your way up the denial tree, and it's exhausting, and it wastes everyone's time, and it takes away from the time that physicians and nurses spend with patients. And that's the thing that's so damaging in the end.
Barbara, thanks again for that call. Elizabeth, I want to start looking towards solutions. Now, last week, the House Committee on Energy and Commerce sent a letter to the insurance company Cigna saying, hey, give us some information about your automated system you're using to deny health insurance claims, based in part on some of the recent reporting you talk about in your piece. Are you optimistic that we could start to see more oversight over these decision processes?
Well, I hope so. I was disappointed. I tried to get a comment from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is tasked with collecting the data, and didn't get a response. I mean, it is their legal obligation. The ACA says shall collect this data. And if they see a plan that's denying 50% of claims, you would hope there would be some sanctions. And the problem now, more than 10 years after the passage of the ACA, is we don't have that information. I mean, even when you're shopping for plans, who would choose a plan that denied 50% of claims, right? We deserve that information, and there deserves to be oversight. So there is, unlike many things in government, there is the power to do this, whether there's the money and the will. You know, it's sad, but I think we're reaching a tipping point now where patients and providers are just so frustrated. It's so unfair, and it's wasting everyone's time, and it's taking patients' money, and it's just not right.
Time for one more caller. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hi. My husband's been going to Mayo Clinic for the past 10 years to get a C11 choline PET scan, which is the only place in the United States that uses the scan to diagnose stage 4 prostate cancer. We've been going for the past 10 years. Medicare has picked it up. We have now, last year, switched to a Medicare Advantage plan, United Healthcare, and we were told when we made the appointment to go this month to Mayo Clinic for the same scan we've been getting for the past 10 years that they denied the claim, United Healthcare did, and we'd have to come with $16,000 or they wouldn't give us the scan. So I called Medicare. They said, yes, indeed, we do cover this, but United Healthcare, whatever type of, we're not staying with them when we have open enrollment, but they've denied it. They won't even go to Medicare first because of whatever structure they have. And we're stuck now with standard scans, which are nowhere as accurate in terms of getting in front of early detection for prostate cancer. So,
Jane, I gotcha. We don't have much time left. Elizabeth, I don't know if that's some of the available data, Medicare Advantage providers compared to Medicare coverage. Do we know their rates of denial claims?
No, we don't. And we should, because, you know, Medicare Advantage plans have networks that are narrower. They have different criteria for coverage. Traditional Medicare generally covers things very generous. I mean, the payments may not be generous, but it covers a wide array of treatments. So you do have to be very careful if you choose to go Medicare Advantage or any narrow network plan. But again, not fair to the patient. Suddenly you're changing the rules of the game 1 year to the next. And how is a patient supposed to know that? It's really hard.
Jane, thanks for that call. And Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Sorry.
That's Elizabeth Rosenthal, Senior Contributing Editor for KFF Health News, with us today for a look at rising rates of health coverage denials by many insurance companies. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you want to clean your house but cut back on chemicals, Kate's guest has advice for you on how to make your own homemade cleaning products. Join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we literally get to the bottom of why people use words like, so, and what's up? Oh, and literally, and dude. Plus, why people get so annoyed by those words. Our guest says it's all a positive sign of the flexibility of spoken English. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about gardening.
Gardening season is upon us. For people blessed with a green thumb, this is their moment to shine. They're sowing the seeds now to reap the rewards later. For others, the idea of planting a garden bed is daunting, especially if you have a bad track record of keeping plants alive. But as Mark Griffin tells us, there is hope, even for the most unskilled gardeners.
For most of my adult life, one general principle allowed me to sow the seeds of doubt in my own head about the prospects of raising a child. If I am unable to keep a plant in my charge alive for a reasonable amount of time, should I really be trusted with a more complex organism? Well, then I had one, and I learned to love in a new way. Still, a haunted past with plants is tough to shake. It started with the silver inch plant my freshman year of college. It turns out you do have to water them. Then I accidentally killed my life partner's favorite ficus by leaving it outside overnight in sub-freezing temps. Plants don't like that. More recently, I've treated other houseplants to spider mites and scale. So when we inherited raised beds in our new backyard, it wasn't carelessness or lack of urgency that led to the perfectly supple dirt going fallow for almost 3 years. I simply did not want to let another innocent piece of greenery die by my hands. So last spring, as my daughter neared the ripe old age of 4, I sought redemption. If not for my sake, then for hers. Data can learn new things too, right? So I sent away for sunflower seeds, and when they arrived, I placed them in the bowl of stuff in the kitchen. Then they sat there. and sad. Towards the end of June, I had a notion. How about we plant these things? On a warm Saturday morning, the intrepid child and I dug out a raised bed to bury some seeds in the ground. Then I looked at my girl and imagined our future. People would come from all over to take Instagram photos of our backyard amongst rows and rows of giant sunflowers, holding their babies up, posing with their wedding parties, complete with honeybee photo bombs. We would become the pride of the neighborhood, and I would be redeemed. Weeks went by, and the weeds thrived. But then I saw three shoots appear. Three. Just days later, in one fell swoop, a rabbit took out two of them, allowing but a single sunflower to remain. I wrapped wire around the remaining stalk, dug stakes, and anchored it with three large boulders. Then, miraculously, the sunflower unfolded to reveal a perfect circle of seeds surrounded by deep yellow petals, waving at us from across the yard. I pointed it out to the kiddo, who was amused, but approached the whole thing with a different confident attitude. Of course the flower bloomed. Then, as summer waned, the sunflower slowly lost its vigor. The petals dreadlocked, while the stem, as tall as the child who planted it, just sort of, kind of, started leaning over. It was time. In one unceremonious hack, I decapitated my summer creation, then let it sit out on our porch where it was pillaged by the neighborhood squirrel. In full mockery, it did leave a single seed that I then placed in the kitchen bowl with the other household jetsam. Until the first rays of spring appeared again. This year, I think I'll take a different tack. Maybe it's time for this dad to look a little closer through the eyes of his daughter, whose breezy focus on the positive comes more naturally than her predecessor. This year, she'll be in charge of the garden, cultivating stronger yields to be reaped in the brisk winds of next season's harvest. No photos allowed.
Mark Griffin is a writer who lives in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. Sunflower,
good morning. Now, the words we use and how we use them say a lot about who we are, where we come from, and our place in that community. The people who nerd out studying all of that, they're called sociolinguists, and our guest is one of them. She's particularly interested in words that people use that other people might see as incorrect or ungrammatical or lazy. Think words like, or or ain't. Where do you fall in words like that? Love them? Hate them? Our guest says there's no wrong way to use English, and there's a lot of history to explain where these words and feelings come from. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself using words like this? You know they're grammatically not quite right, but it just fits. Is it different depending on who you're talking to? How do people respond to it? Are you annoyed by what you see as the misuse of language? Or are you annoyed by people who correct this kind of language? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. She writes a popular language blog on Psychology Today called Language in the Wild and is a professor for the Great Courses series. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and talk with you.
Well, I could have gone with another greeting like this one.
What's up? What's up? Yo, who's that?
Yo!
So, Valerie, you write about that old classic, "Was up, beer ad," and that's an example of how we might use unusual or not quite to the rule book English language to connect with other people.
Absolutely. When we talk to each other, we're really about connection rather than grammatical correctness. And I think that sometimes we forget this when we overhear people and find what they say annoying.
Can you talk about the difference between English as a careful system of rules that we observe or not observe at our peril and language English as we actually use it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times what we do is we live in these ideas of what good language is and what bad language is based on essentially a social construction that has been around for only about 200 years, this idea of prescriptive grammar, of rules that you should follow. And I'm not saying that language has no rules. Language has a million rules, but they're cognitive and articulatory rules that guide us in understanding what people say and constructing sentences that other people will understand. But a rule like don't end a sentence with a preposition or two negatives make a positive are actually essentially made up rules in the 18th century by people that wanted English to be more like Latin. So those are social rules about what we think is proper and polite language. Those really have very little to do with the rules that underlie the system of language. And it's really more about what we think is good for making connections, for showing our social identity, for letting people understand both information about what we're trying to get across, the point or the information itself, but also ideas about how we feel about that information, how we feel about the relationship we have with that speaker, and things about our social identity, like our gender and our ethnicity. And those are really important parts of the reasons we communicate.
Now let's get into some of the bad, I'll always throw that in quotes, English you talk about here. Go back to the 90s again, actually. The 1995 comedy Clueless demonstrates a lot of this. The main character, Cher, arguing in a high school debate class in favor of oppressed people being allowed refuge in America.
So, okay, like right now, for example, the Haitians need to come to America. But some people are all, what about the strain on our resources? But it's like when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? I said RSVP because it was a sit-down dinner. But people came that, like, did not RSVP. So I was, like, totally bugging.
All right, you tackle a lot of these words. Some of them have their own chapter in your book. Let's start with like. It appears like a meaningless word. I just said it there. I'm going to keep catching myself saying it. We often judge people who say liked too much. But hold on, you write, like is actually doing something in our sentences, Valerie.
Absolutely. It's doing a lot. And one of the reasons I think we don't like it, now it's, we're going to notice every like we say, is because it does so many different things and we're not all on the same page about what it's doing. So all of us know like as a verb and even a noun, like your dislikes and your likes. We often use it as a preposition, like in a simile, and a lot of us have even crept into using it as a conjunction with things like it feels like, it seems like, he pretends like, and all of those likes are pretty well accepted. They don't bug us so much, but what does bug us is the new forms of like, and part of that is because of who is using them, which is often young speakers, often female speakers, two groups that we tend to disdain how they talk. But it's also because we don't maybe understand all the functions so that it feels like it's just omnipresent when really it's doing different things. And you can use like, for example, as an approximator where about would go. So he's like 12. There's no difference between saying he's like 12 and he's about 12, except for the age of the user. It's still doing that same work that the about is doing as an approximator. And you can use it as a discourse particle to express emphasis. So something like, I was waiting like 20 hours for you, where obviously it's not really 20 hours, but I'm just telling you, hey, I'm pretty annoyed with you because you were late. And so it's emphatic and hyperbolic in that sense. And we convey a lot of emotionality that way with hyperbolic statements. So it's functioning as something that we would do in a different way. So you might instead use like there instead of saying, you know, I'm really annoyed with you because you took so long. And it's a much cooler, hipper way to say it. And then finally, use it as a quotative verb where you're talking not only about what someone said, but even more subtly, what they might be thinking as an event was unfolding, which is not really something you can do with the verb to say very well. So here, like adds a nuance of meaning that to say doesn't. So if I said something such as, I was like, I just can't do this. What that's telling my listener is that's not necessarily something I verbatim said. It's what I was thinking in the moment that the event I'm describing was happening, which is different than I said, if I said, and I said, I just can't do this, which would convey an actual verbatim quote. So there it's actually adding a really useful nuance of meaning. I think our objection with like is that sometimes it feels like people overuse it. And that's very different. Because someone might overuse it in a context doesn't mean the word itself is meaningless. It just means maybe that person is using it a little excessively.
We're talking to Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics in the English department in the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how the language changes? Do you have a generation gap in your family where maybe kids or grandkids use words or phrases that are more or less unintelligible to you or annoyingly incorrect as you hear it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Valerie Friedland, linguistics professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers. Richard is with us in Manitowoc. Richard, hi.
Hi. It's been driving me crazy. I listen to NPR all day long, and I notice a lot of times they answer questions with an answer, but they put a little inflection on the end of the answer, like it's a question. And I just drive me nuts lately, and I didn't know why they're doing this so often, more than I've ever heard before.
Richard, thanks for the call. Valerie, I think it's this thing called uptalk.
Yes, definitely called uptalk. But if you're a linguist, we call it a high rising terminal, just to be fancy.
Ooh.
And make it sound impressive. And what's really interesting is intonation patterns often vary by speaker. They vary by language and they might vary by dialect. But when one intonation pattern gets associated very much with some sort of pragmatic information, like signaling that this is going to be a question, then people get really tied to that one meaning associated with that intonational pattern. And that's what's happened with this high rising terminal. We hear it often when we are finishing a question. And so because of that use in one context, we have then generalized that to other contexts so that when people use high rising terminals to indicate continuation, meaning they're going to keep talking, they're not finished with what they're going to say, which is where we find it used in this way that the caller was talking about, those that are really used to it being a question intonation pattern find it really difficult to see it as something different. But for those that use it, which is often women, there have been certainly studies that show women use more uptalk than men. It seems to indicate that they're not done talking yet. And if you look at the history of women's and women's speech, we find that women tend to be interrupted at a much higher rate than men do, which seems to suggest that people don't read their cues of continuing what they're going to say or feel that it's okay to interrupt them. And so what we find is women have often adopted some speech habits that help encourage the keeping of their turn or proper turn alignment between speakers. And high rising terminal seems to be one of those where if we do a test, which we have done with perception tests, and we have high rising terminals and we ask people what it means, it usually means either a question or in the middle of a sentence, when they're sort of continuing on, it means generally a non-finality. So people seem to read it as that person's continuing what they're going to say and I shouldn't break in. And I think that's really why it's become more prevalent in speech today.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call. And Valerie, a couple things you said remind me of this paradox in your book. Young women speakers, I think, are most commonly made fun of anyone for things they may do differently. But if you want to study the future of a language, look toward young women because they're the ones who develop the things that end up coming into place in the future. What's going on?
Absolutely. A lot of our linguistic disdain is targeted towards women and young women in particular. And it's partially because young women are the innovators in language. Even when we look several centuries back at letters and diaries from the early modern period, new changes coming into the language, like starting to say does and has instead of doth and hath, starting to say you for subjects instead of ye and things like that, starting to use progressive forms of verbs to indicate habitual or continuous action. All of these things were brought into the language through women's speech. We see much higher rates of these novel features in early modern letters and diaries in women's language. And then fast forward to modern times, again, things like using literally, non-literally, using like as an intensifier, these forms that we don't really love, using a going to instead of will, those are all led by young women. So we have this pattern where young women lead in language change. We also have this pattern where historically young women's voices are not welcome in public forums, and we tend to disdain their voices themselves. And so you put that in a mix, in a blender, and what you come up with is dislike for young women's voices because they're doing new things that we're not used to, that we consider rule breaking. And they're also voices that we don't tend to love in those contexts anyway. And so doing something new and novel when you're already a disfavored group tends to get you in trouble. And that's pretty much what we find with young women's features today.
Talking to Valerie Friedland, her new book is Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Back to your calls now. Marshall is with us in Price County. Marshall, hi.
Hey, how are you? I'm wondering why people always say, I mean, when they're asking in question.
Oh, Marshall, you're breaking up a little bit, but that's starting the conversation or the sentence with, I mean, blah, blah. Or people, and I do this sometimes, so blah, 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 blah. Why do we set up our new topics that way, Valerie?
You know, it's funny. I mean, and so are two of the things I hear about the most when people talk about things that annoy them, in addition to the ones in the book. And both of those are in a category that we call discourse markers, which are words that often come at the beginning of a sentence that serve to do something to the organization or structure of what you're saying, where they either relate it back to what was previously said, or in the cases of those in particular, they are trying to orient the listener to a particular stance or opinion that the speaker has. So usually when you say so at the beginning of a sentence, it follows something that requires additional explanation before you get to the point that directly addresses the thing that was before. It's called the backstory so. So when someone, and I just put it there, so when someone says so at the beginning of a statement, it usually means that I'm going to take a little diversion from the direct answer to what you said so that I can explain some other additional component of meaning here that's going to be relevant to what I'm going to say to answer your question. And then I mean usually clarifies something that was previously said, often something a speaker said themselves, and then they'll say something and say, I mean, I didn't really think that, where they're doing a little extra clarification and they're sort of signaling to the listener that this clarification is about to take place. So they're both listenership devices. They're helping with the conversational structure. And we find when we look at research on who uses those kinds of markers more often, discourse markers, it tends to people that rank, tends to be people that rank high on conscientious scales on psychological tests. So it's actually to help with conversational flow. Sometimes people use them excessively and we start to notice them. But if we look at studies on people that compared passages with discourse markers and those without, people feel the discourse markers help with the flow and make it less robotic than when they're absent.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Lisa and Madison, who couldn't stay on the line, wondering why some people pronounce the T in some words like a D, like little versus little. And I was thinking, Valerie, reading your book about T's, like the sentence, do you want some butter on your toast? If I say, do you want some butter on your toast? Those are two very different sentences. They mean something different about me. With just a minute left, the meaning of how those how we pronounce those letters.
Well, T is very handy because it does provide a big shortcut to speaker identity. So if you say, you want some butter, then that tells me I'm a Cockney speaker, right? It tells you something about where I come from. If I say, you want some butter, that identifies you as an American speaker because it's called a flap. That T that's pronounced like a D between a stressed and unstressed syllable is something that only developed in the United States after most of the colonists had settled here. So British speakers either glottalize, so ba-a, or they pronounce the T, butta. But an American says butter.
Thanks for that question. And Valerie, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her new book is called Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Do you want some butter on your toast? That sounds sinister to me. Like, I'd see that character in a movie. I don't think I like that character. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a good apology can go a long way, but a bad one can make a situation even worse. We'll get some great advice on how to make amends with the author of the book, Sorry, Sorry, Sorry. And movies that are based on books are sometimes better than the original, than their inspiration. We'll get some recommendations on great book to movie adaptations and hear some of your favorites. You can email your favorite book to movie adaptation right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.